Welcome to the second dialogue session under our CSEN Step Up to Lead podcast. The key remit of this series of podcasts is to provide a platform for our listeners to assimilate leadership insights from exemplary leaders and from subject matter experts. My name is Geraldine Joseph, and I am the CSEN Center Senior Analyst in charge of developing and delivering programs in the central banking leadership and governance domain. For this podcast, please join me in welcoming the one and only Mr. Rajiv Peshawaria, the outgoing Executive Director of Executive Education, Asia School of Business, Kuala Lumpur. For those of you who are not familiar, the Asia School of Business is a collaboration between Bank Negara Malaysia and the MIT Sloan School of Management. For the next 45 minutes or so, Rajiv will be sharing with us his nuggets of wisdom on leadership based on his many years as a leadership consultant and a C-suite leader in a number of organizations. Rajiv was the former CEO of the ICLIF Leadership and Governance Center Kuala Lumpur. Apart from being a heavily sought-after international speaker, he's the author of two fascinating bestsellers, Open Source Leadership and Too Many Bosses, Too Few Leaders. His prior professional experience includes being the Chief Learning Officer for both Coca-Cola and Morgan Stanley. He has been named as one of the top 100 global thought leaders for trustworthy business by Trust Across America. It is indeed a great privilege to have you with us, Rajiv. I'm aware that it is your last day today with the Asia School of Business. Thank you for obliging to do this with us before you clock out at end day. Rajiv, to begin with, how about succinctly taking us through your professional journey and enlightening us on how you came to build a solid career in the area of leadership development after devoting the early part of your professional journey to being a banker and currency trader? Over to you, Rajiv.
Thank you, Geraldine. As I started my career in banking and soon became a trader, I became concerned about how young people who were coming into the workforce were quickly getting disillusioned. These were people with lots of hopes, lots of aspirations to do great things, but they were getting stuck under managers who were completely unaware of themselves and were sort of literally stifling these young people. And the older ones themselves, they were also, because they were unaware of themselves, were unaware of their own potential. So here were smart people in the banking industry. They could give so much to the world if only they could wake up. That's kind of what my observation was. And long story short, that's what prompted me to start reading and learning about leadership, human behavior, psychology. And eventually, I decided to make that my career.
Interesting. I can identify with all that you've just mentioned. And now with your departure from the Asia School of Business, please share with us what you perceive have been your milestones in leading the ICLIF Leadership and Governance Center for the last 8 years and subsequently steering the integration of ICLIF with the Asia School of Business to offer a broader set of business education offerings.
So, you know, I came here 10 years ago, and we wanted at that time ICLIF to become a respected center for leadership and governance. But we have no brand, we had no recognition, and we were in a part of the world that is not necessarily known to produce thought leadership in this area. So the challenge was, how do we go about becoming a world-class center? And the answer we came up with was, we need to challenge conventional wisdom. If we offer the same old that everybody's offering, then how would anybody differentiate us? How would we be any different? So we had to find ways to challenge conventional wisdom. We did that by redefining leadership and governance. In terms of leadership, we said that leadership cannot be about titles, it cannot be about positions, it cannot be about telling people what to do. It has to be about a burning desire to create a better future. And it has to be about knowing how not to give up in the face of resistance. And governance has to be more about prevention and less about punishment. It has to have equal focus on value preservation and value creation, not just overly focused on value preservation, which is what most governance is all about. So we started out by redefining leadership and governance that way. Then we introduced the concept of leadership energy, which is the inner strength that prevents people like Nelson Mandela from giving up even through 27 years in prison. We said that if people could only understand that everybody has long-lasting leadership energy like Mandela, the world would become automatically a better place. So we started promoting this concept of leadership energy. We came up with a leadership energy conference that we started doing every year in Asia, which became very popular. We started something called the ICLIF Leadership Energy Awards, recognizing people every year who were like heroes of leadership energy, people who had changed the world with their desire to create a better future. And we created a curriculum of leadership and governance, which had only one goal, which is to wake people and wake organizations up to their potential. And by doing all of this, we managed to grow from one country to 30 countries, started serving marquee brands around the world. And our messages started resonating with people because they were sincere and they were different.
And a lead on to that point on challenging conventional wisdom, what has been the most gratifying part for you in leading people during your stint in KL? What legacy might you be bequeathing your team in KL?
Well, as I was saying, I've tried to teach people to wake up to their true potential by discovering their own leadership energy. If they can discover their leadership energy, anything is possible. I've tried to redefine the meaning of courage. If your purpose is based on the right values, and if it is bigger than yourself, you lose fear. If you lose fear, you can achieve anything you want. Mm. I've tried to redefine power away from position and authority towards moral respect. You have more power if people respect and love you for who you are than the power that is given to you by authority. I've tried to teach, for example, regulators and civil servants and other powerful bosses to discover their real power and not hide behind formal authority. I've tried to impress upon people that leading with freedom is far more powerful than leading with control and fear. But to give up, to give freedom to others, you have to free yourself from ego and insecurity first. So I hope my legacy is that some people will wake up to these ideas and decide to make a world a better place with their leadership energy.
Splendid. You have also held leadership positions in several organizations in the US. In your assessment, Rajiv, are there differences in leading people in the West compared to leading people in the East, considering cultural differences, for example?
The short answer is no. I have lived in 8 countries for considerable lengths of time, and I have delivered projects in, maybe over 100 countries. But let's talk about the 8 that I actually lived in for a number of years each and managed large teams in those cultures. And I can tell you, I did not have to change a thing about my leadership style because I was in Japan or because I was in Sydney or because I was in New York or London. I think it's a myth that you have to lead people differently in different cultures. Yes, there are cultural differences, and you've got to learn to respect cultural differences, and you've got to communicate differently in different cultural settings because the same words and the same actions can mean two opposite things in two different cultures. But at the end of the day, what people expect of their leaders in order to be fully motivated, in order to give their very best, those expectations are innately human and they don't change across cultures.
So it strikes me that the crux of the matter is to have clarity on what leadership is per se. Almost every self-help book on leadership I come across, however, claims a unique definition for this act of leading. In your view, what are some of the biggest misconceptions about leadership?
So, let me tell you a quick story before I answer that question. So, you know, for the last, 15 years or more, every time I do a leadership course or a seminar, I get people into groups of 5 to 7 people and get them to complete the sentence, leadership is the act of. And I give them a limit of 15 words. And no matter whether there are 25 people in the room or no matter if there are 1,000 people in the room, what happens each time is every group comes up with a definition that is almost identical. And what does that composite look like? It is that leadership is the act of motivating, inspiring, coaching, developing, thising or thatting people towards achieving some common objectives. In 15 years, I have not come across a different definition than that. I've done this exercise almost every week. So then I ask people, wow, what's common in all your definitions? Isn't it that leadership is about what a leader does to other people? Because if it's about inspiring, motivating, thising and thatting people, then it is what a leader does to other people, right? And everybody says yes. And I say no. That is the first misconception of leadership. Leadership is not what you do to other people. To be a leader, you do not have to have formal followers. That is the biggest misconception. Look at Mahatma Gandhi. Look at Nelson Mandela. Did they do anything to other people? They did not have any authority. Mandela was in prison for 27 years. They did not have any formal authority or office for most of their lives. Whatever they did to themselves. And by so doing, they became great examples that people automatically wanted to follow them. Followership was a byproduct of their leading themselves. So that's the first misconception. The other misconception is that we've been forever confusing and rewarding followership as leadership. Right? As we are children, our parents tell us what to do, and we get rewarded if we follow them and follow their instructions, and we get punished if we don't. That trend continues in school and college. The teacher's pet in every classroom anywhere in the world is the most obedient child. And not only that, that child is rewarded for that obedience by being made the monitor of the class. In the corporate world, we tell people you better be good managers and good leaders, and we will reward you and punish you accordingly. How do we measure? By looking at their employee survey results. And that makes them pleasers, not leaders. Even in the boardroom, boards are more interested in you following best practices rather than creating next practices. You come up with an innovative idea in the boardroom, and the first question they ask you is, have 5 other companies already done that? So right from childhood all the way to the boardroom, we've been confusing followership and rewarding it. That's the second misconception. The third misconception is that position power is the same thing as leadership. Just because you are the prime minister, you are the leader of the country. Just because you are the CEO, you are the leader of the company. That is a big misconception. Because those are titles that make people bosses. What makes them lead is what they do, how they be, and what they give to the world, not what they get from the world.
So in a sense, you would advocate the notion of being a role model to others. Absolutely. Am I right?
And followership will happen automatically.
Right. So how do you then personally bring enduring meaning to this word leadership? In a sense, you talked about leadership energy. Could you elaborate? Because indeed, in almost all your leadership programs, you would ardently stress on the importance of discovering one's purpose in life and creating a better future. Do you mind sharing with us how you discovered your purpose? And what is the better future you wish to create? What exactly fuels that fire in your belly, Rajiv?
So my purpose is to wake up as many people and as many organizations as possible. Leadership is a burning desire to create a better future. It's not a title. It's not a set of competencies. It's not a God-given gift. It's certainly not following best practices. In simple terms, it is a burning desire to create a better future. And when you say you're going to change something in order to create a better future, what you get from the world is resistance. And most people, their default is they need to be loved, they need to be liked, they need to be accepted. So they give up in the face of that resistance. The moment you give up in the face of resistance, you are giving up your leadership. So leadership is the art of creating a better future and not giving up. What do you need in order to not give up? You need tremendous amounts of leadership energy, which is the inner power that prevents you from giving up. How do you get that leadership energy? You become super clear and start living by a set of values that you believe to be right and moral. And you give yourself a purpose in life based on those values. If your purpose is based on your values, and if it is bigger than yourself, you lose fear. If you lose fear, you don't give up. If you don't give up, anything is possible. Now you are living your life awake. My purpose in life is to get this message across to as many people in the world as possible, because that's how they will go on and make the world a better place.
What was the turning point in your life, Rajiv, when you discovered your purpose?
Well, like I said, it started with long time ago when I was working in the banking industry. I saw a lot of people who were incredibly smart, very capable of giving something to the world, but the focus that most people had is, what can I get from the world? And I said, no, that can't be. I mean, by all means, it's okay to want to be rich and want to be successful in the material sense, but why can't people be successful by giving to the world something meaningful? Why can't material success, wealth, and power and fame be a byproduct of real leadership rather than the purpose of life itself? I saw too many people just caught in that rut of power and product and not achieving what they were truly capable of. That was the wake-up call for me, honestly.
That very neatly brings me to this next question. Is it possible for leaders to be selfless all the time? What are your views on servant leadership?
Actually, I think that nobody can be selfless at all. This thing about one leadership should be, leaders should be selfless, is a highly overrated and misunderstood term. Nobody can be and nobody should be selfless. We are all driven by self-interest, okay? And the question is it bad to be selfish? Is it bad to be driven by self-interest? No. If what you want for yourself makes the world a better place, what's wrong with that? Now, even if you're Mother Teresa, is she doing it selflessly? If whatever she did in her life, did she do it completely selflessly only to serve the world, or did she do it also for herself? Somewhere deep inside her, there was this need to be recognized as the world's most caring giver. So in that sense, she was doing it for herself. Some people want to accumulate wealth and power by going out and making tons of money. By becoming biggest conglomerate leaders in the world. Some people want to become famous by giving to the world. All in both cases, it is driven by selfishness, not by selflessness. And my point is, as long as your self-ambition is not harming the world, as long as it is giving something to the world, what's wrong with it? You take the self out of me, there's nothing left.
In your book, Too Many Bosses, Too Few Leaders, at the very outset, you pointed out that people across a wide range of industries in almost every continent say that of all the bosses they have had in their career, on average, only between 0 and 2 can be regarded as great leaders. Something must be terribly wrong with the human race. Pray tell me, why is there a lack of strong leadership in the world, and what needs to be urgently done to address this issue?
I think we already covered this, Geraldine, because I talked earlier about the leadership misconceptions. You know, it's the people think that leadership is about doing something to other people. People think it's about following best practices, etc., etc. If we remove those misconceptions, and if we understand that leadership is the art of harnessing human energy towards the creation of a better future, I think that's when things will change. As long as bosses think that, you know, my job as a leader is to tell people what to do and to command and control them, we won't get better. That is the difference. So the ratio will change only when people begin to start understanding that leadership is a lot more about risk management.
Right, Rajiv. But there's quite a bit of research out there on the failure of leadership programs in enabling leaders to be the best version of themselves. And this despite the vast amounts invested in leadership training. In your view, what can those of us in the leadership development domain do better to ensure participants apply the learning and sustain their leadership journey? What makes for truly effective leadership programs?
So first of all, shun competency models. Most leadership development is programs are based on some kind of a competency model that in order to be a leader, you have to have the following 16 things. So let's teach you those 16 things. No, leadership is not about competency. Most leadership programs also base themselves on case studies. So in some schools, you go for a leadership program, and for a week or 2 weeks or 8 weeks, all you read and discuss is case study after case study after case study. You do not become great leaders by reading case studies. Thirdly, a lot of the focus of leadership development, traditional leadership development, is on psychometric personality testing. There is no one personality type that is better suited for leadership. So let's shun competency models, case studies, and psychometrics, and let's go below the surface. To really wake up the leader in me, you need to make me understand who I really am, why am I in this world, what are the values that drive me, and what purpose can I give myself? That is should be the essence of leadership development, which is helping people understand their values and purpose, which is their leadership energy. We've got it all wrong. We focus all of leadership development on the surface skills, but actual leadership is hidden deep inside us.
Thank you for those suggestions, Rajiv. If we could now shift our attention to the individual level, you talked a little bit about some of the preconditions for powerful leadership. Are there any other prerequisites that you would like to touch on in making a good leader?
I think this awareness as to who I am and what do I want to give to the world, and the awareness that it is not about commanding and controlling other people, but about driving myself to give as much to the world as I can give, is the main precondition. It's a mindset more than anything else.
And who, in your view, in past and modern history, can be very much considered to exemplify these positive leadership attributes you just articulated?
I meet great leaders in my life every single week, except that they are nameless and they are not famous people. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of people have decided that they are going to make their life worth it. So they've made the shift from maximizing their net worth to maximizing their life worth, which is kind of about giving to the world, as I've been talking about. If you want me to name some famous ones, well, again, like I said, people like Gandhi, people like Mandela, people like Martin Luther King, and a whole host of CEOs who are actually more concerned about making the world a better place and less concerned about maximizing shareholder wealth, there are plenty of people.
On leadership challenges, what do you think is the most difficult leadership challenge in this current landscape of volatility and uncertainty, emanating amongst others from the raging COVID-19 pandemic and unprecedented technological acceleration?
I think the biggest challenge is to overcome fear. Bosses first need to overcome their own fear by giving themselves the gift of leadership energy, and then coming up with innovative solutions. They need to create conditions for innovation to happen. You see, today we are faced with the COVID-19 challenge. The human race has an excellent history of overcoming challenges. Right from the dawn of humanity, that's what we've done. We've overcome challenges. When we felt cold in the jungles, we discovered fires. When we had to protect ourselves from the elements, we found ways to cover ourselves under initially caves and then build huts and tenements. We have since then till today used science, technology, and innovation to overcome every challenge that humanity has faced. And the current challenge is something that we will also overcome. There is no question in my mind about that. So the challenge is not, you know, external. The challenge is internal. And if you call yourself a leader, your single most important job should be to remove fear and to create conditions in which the minds of the people who work with you are free of fear and can focus on innovation.
Right. And I suppose one of the greatest challenges coming from what I'm hearing from you is to deal with that ambiguity that is inherent in this crisis. And this is a timeless issue in any leadership job. During a crisis like the pandemic, as you've correctly mentioned, fear becomes contagious. How would you as a leader overcome that fear, Rajiv?
You first have to accept reality. A lot of people remain in denial when it comes to a crisis. You have to accept reality and ask yourself, how bad can this be? Because, you know, it's like if you are standing on the 40th floor of a building and if you throw a ball down from the window, the only way it can bounce up is if it first hits the floor. It cannot bounce up midway. Similarly, you have to accept reality. Only then can you find solutions. That's the first thing. Second, you have to literally shift your mindset from if only to what if. And you have to do that quickly. People say, oh, if only this virus would go away. If only the MCO would be lifted soon, the movement control order would be lifted soon. If only this, if only that. No, what if? And get to possibilities. And when things are unclear and ambiguous, as you said, and you're waiting for the bigger picture to get clearer in your head, then focus on short-term goals and focus your team on short-term goals until the bigger picture becomes clear. What can we do today? What can we do this week while we are solving for the bigger thing? Because that focusing them on something removes fear again, and I'm able to control something. And then finally, throughout the crisis, celebrate small victories.
You sound like one who would always look for opportunities in every situation, and you keep a positive mindset.
That's the key. I mean, if you keep reminding yourself of doom and gloom scenarios, guess what? That's what will happen, because all reality is created in our mind.
Rajiv, your book, Open Source Leadership, opens a window to novel and provocative ideas on leadership in this digital age. Do share with us your key thoughts on your notion of benevolent autocracy that you have alluded to as perhaps the only way to solve the 21st century leadership dilemma.
Well, you see, in today's world of 24/7 connectivity and digitalization, speed is everything. And there are lots of visionary people, but if they don't implement their visions with high speed, somebody else will do it. So question is, if you have a visionary idea to make something better, should you go about building consensus and get everybody on board first, or should you go about implementing it with a few people that believe in you? That's the dilemma, okay? And the thing about connectivity is this. Today, everybody has a voice. And therefore, because of connectivity, everybody and anybody can have their voices heard. They can join just about any debate. And by law of averages, if everybody can join every debate, there can be no consensus. So the inconvenient truth is this, that if you are a visionary and you want to do something, you have to do it with some amount of autocracy. Now, the moment you say the word autocracy, all kinds of negative connotations come to mind. But the fact is, you don't have to worry about it, because if everybody, the worry is that if everybody becomes autocratic, then the world will be full of dictators. No, the other thing about the digital age is that ordinary people are more empowered than ever before. If you become a ruthless dictator, they will bring you down. Think Arab Spring. That's the power ordinary people have. So there is a built-in audit mechanism preventing people from crossing the line. if they go to the other side, they will be brought down. And that is the beauty of the digital era. So to be able to create positive change, my argument there is that you have to be a positive autocrat. And I lay out 5 keys of positive autocracy in the book. But this is not just my opinion. We talked to 28 people in 28 countries, 16 or 17,000 people, and asked them what they think. And they all agreed that positive autocracy is the way to go. All that research is in the book.
So positive autocracy includes the element of compassion.
Absolutely. Compassion, empathy, forgiveness. You remain autocratic about your values and your purpose, and you give freedom to people on just about everything else. That's positive autocracy. Those two things, values and purpose, are non-negotiable. You also forgive more often.
As an ex-central banker, that notion of benevolent autocracy resonates very much with me, and hence a follow-up question. While in Eclif, you have had the experience of delivering a range of leadership programs to central bankers from across the Asian region. Based on your interactions with central bank participants and exposure to central banking itself, how vital would you perceive the need for our central bankers to build their leadership skills if compared to strengthening their acumen in the more technical areas, for example, financial supervision?
So first of all, I don't think it's an either or. In today's complex world, you absolutely have to continue to build your technical expertise and get better and better at it. Central bankers are no exception. The people that are trying to cause harm in this world are also continuously upgrading their skills. So if central bankers don't, that will not be a good thing. You also have to continuously look at yourself as in your leadership skills. You've got to do both. And for central bankers, having interacted with a lot of them, not only in Asia, but around the world, my only appeal is this. Ask yourself, are you using your authority or are you using your leadership energy when getting people to do what you want them to do? Because leadership is getting people to do something because they want to, not because they have to. And when it comes to people who have a lot of given authority, what happens is they don't use their real power, which is their leadership energy. So the idea, even for central bankers, should be the same. We want to make the world a better place.
Well, fundamentally, Rajiv, you are saying that leadership skills are essential skills for everyone, no matter your title and position.
Absolutely. And the people who use their title, position, and authority to influence others to do what they want, they are not leaders, in my view. When you use formal authority to press people to do what you want them to do, you get compliance, you don't get entire followership. To create positive change in society, you have to use genuine values and purpose, your leadership energy, so that people do the right thing even when you're not looking.
While I've always believed that leadership can be learned and leaders can be made, I now also recognize that some great leaders have innate wow factors that might be difficult to emulate. One such person who springs to mind is Jack Welch, who led General Electric through 2 decades of extraordinary corporate prosperity. And of course, other widely recognized leaders, Indra Nooyi, former CEO of PepsiCo, and Steve Jobs of Apple, to name a few. What is your view that exceptional leaders are not necessarily made, but might also be naturally gifted?
No, so my view is that they are not born, they are definitely made. All the people that you mentioned, I don't think they were born with any special skills. They lived their life awake. They asked themselves the question, who am I? What do I want to do for the world? And that's how they became the leaders that they became. Indra Nooyi is a great example. I recently heard her say in an interview that people ask her all the time, how can I become a CEO? How can I become like you? And she said that that's the wrong question. Don't ask how I can become a CEO, how I can become more powerful. Ask what you can give to the world and what is it that you have that nobody else can do. And that will give you the rewards anyway. So The question is not born or made. The question is, are you awake or are you asleep?
Rajiv, you come across as a formidable and resilient leader, very much awake and always trying to overcome fear. I am curious, what do you think would matter most to you at the end of your professional journey? If you were a 90-year-old man reflecting on your past achievements and tribulations, what would you like to particularly look back at and say that you were proud of?
That we permanently changed the way the world sees leadership and governance, away from taking to giving.
Ooh, I like that. Something I should reflect on too. On that note, my final question. Now that you are leaving KL, if I could pry a little, and I'm sure our listeners would like to know, what are you planning to do next professionally? As a top-notch consultant and educator, I assume that the opportunities are manifold for you. What are your plans, Rajiv?
Well, the destination that I am heading towards never changes. So the work that I will do starting tomorrow will be exactly the same work, which is wake up as many people and as many organizations and also continue to help organizations to excel in this new world of connectivity and digitalization. So the work never changes, the destination doesn't change. The only thing that changes is the vehicle. And so what I will be doing next is running my own organization called the Leadership Energy Consulting Company, based out of Seattle, Washington. The goal is to reach as many organizations, as many people, and help them understand what it truly means to lead, what it truly means to govern, what it truly means to be happy, what it truly means to have courage. So the work will never change. I'm only changing the vehicle.
Rajiv, rest assured, we are going to continue to tap on your intellectual resourcefulness.
Thank you.
May I, on behalf of the CSEN Center, extend our best wishes to you as you embark on this next chapter in your life. Thank you very much for sharing your insights on leadership with us today. For those of us who have had the pleasure of listening to you at leadership programs or being coached by you, we wholeheartedly applaud you for inspiring us, Rajiv. Thank you very much for all you've done for us here in this region. And listeners, we hope this podcast has provided you with a number of compelling takeaways to reflect upon. Till we connect again, may I wish you an incredible, incredible journey in stepping up to lead yourself and others. Stay safe and positive. Thank you for listening.